From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, day 19 of the partial government shutdown over the president's demand for a border wall, and Congress is as divided as ever.
We need to have border security, and I, at this point, am a no in voting for opening the government and funding the other parts of the government without addressing that very serious issue.
What we're not going to buy into is to give him a lump sum to build a wall from sea to shining sea. No border security expert thinks that makes any sense.
Native Americans determined to keep camping near the Straits of Mackinac, demanding Live 5 be shut down.
My ancestors are going to ask me what I did to protect this land that they gave me. They're going to ask me what I did, and I can't say that I didn't do anything.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is day 19 of the partial government shutdown. On Friday, 800,000 federal workers will miss their paychecks. And as you're about to hear, arguments put forth last night by President Trump and Democratic leaders about the border wall failed to change minds on either side of the aisle in Michigan's congressional delegation. We begin with GOP Representative Bill Huizinga of West Michigan's 2nd District. Congressman, did President Trump make an effective case last night for his border wall?
Well, I think he certainly, this was one of his best performances because he was focused in on it, you know, having 8 or 10 minutes on that. I think it has been on the back burner in a way for the American people because they're not seeing a lot of the effects as lapses in funding have done in the past. And obviously, I was critical of the last administration when I characterized it as weaponized the shutdown, shutting down the open air, you know, memorials and those kinds of things. So, you know, there's been frankly a lack of I think day-to-day pain for people that maybe has allowed them to not be paying attention as closely. When we're dealing though with TSA and our border agents and Coast Guard and others that are being affected, I think that is becoming much more real for people back home.
What about the case that he was trying to present to the American people that border wall is needed? Do you think he did a good job of selling that to the public?
I think he did a reasonable job with that. I think it's going to be an ongoing conversation. It needs to be that. It needs to be more forceful. I think we need to see some movement on all sides. What's most frustrating to me is that, you know, the House has had passed a bill before the end of the last Congress, we have not seen any real good faith negotiations out of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, from my opinion, as they've been going in and saying, look, we're not going to do anything until the government is open. That to me is not reasonable. And the bottom line is we know that both of those leaders have supported border security initiatives in the past. I voted on this back in the Obama administration as well as the Trump administration. We've all seen the video of President Obama and others talking about the need for this increase in border security. So I don't understand how having 400,000 apprehensions at the border yet a year, which is a 20-year low, by the way, it does not underscore the significance and the seriousness of the issue.
When we talk border security, let's siphon down to the physical wall that he's demanding. Is that the best solution to address security issues at the border of the United States?
No, I've been very clear about this for a number of years, actually, that I don't believe that a poured concrete wall is practical along the entire southern border. Why? Because we have a significant amount of our border in the middle of the Rio Grande. We should not, nor can we, cede that territory to Mexico and have somebody else. We know that there's agricultural needs for the Rio Grande and other places, but we do have areas where we have to have a physical barrier. We also need more agents. We need more technology to stop people and illicit products from coming across the border. So that to me, I use the term border integrity because we need to know who and what is crossing our border, and we need to make sure that it's done in a legal fashion.
Congressman, there have been reports a number of lawmakers are getting pressure from their constituents to end the shutdown. There are apparently, reportedly, some Republicans considering backing the Democrats' bill that would reopen the government without border wall funding. What are you hearing from your constituents?
Yeah, we're hearing from both sides. I would say the majority of the folks and the responses that I have seen have been encouraging of pushing the issue of border security. And again, I think this kind of goes back to your first question, which is, are people seeing really the effects or the day-to-day pain of not having government fully functioning? And it does beg the question, you know, we have those essential workers of the 800,000. We've got a significant number of those that have been deemed essential. What is the role of these non-essential folks, and what are they doing? And we need to make sure that we are, frankly, sharpening up our government spending overall. This is not the way to do it, but we do need to be looking at how we are using those tax dollars effectively.
Would you support reopening the federal government without that border wall funding?
Well, we need to have border security, and I, at this point, am a no in voting for opening the government and funding the other parts of the government without addressing that very serious issue.
What's the best way to end this impasse, do you think?
Yeah, negotiate. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer need to get serious about negotiating this. Last night, Mike Pence came in along with Secretary Nielsen to talk to our conference. I had a direct conversation with both of them. It's clear that they are ready, willing, and able to have the conversation. Having government open before there is negotiations of any sort just doesn't seem like a reasonable position from my standpoint, because that is the pressure point of trying to drive forward those negotiations.
Michigan GOP Congressman Bill Huizinga, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Hey, thanks, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
And now we turn to Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint. Congressman, did President Trump advance his case last night for a border wall?
I don't think he did. You know, basically, he gave the same argument that he's been giving since he initiated this whole crisis. It was a moment that he could have used to rise above the relatively low level of political discourse that he has encouraged in this country. He could have said, look, let's open the government. I believe there's common ground. I'm willing to commit to find that common ground through the process that the framers of our government created 200 years ago. But we're not going to shut the government down to get it. He missed that opportunity, and it seems as though today he's sort of doubling down on these bully tactics, and it's very unfortunate.
He did start last night, and he used the word humanitarian crisis. Does that crack open a door in any way in your mind?
Well, only in the sense that the humanitarian crisis that we face is one that is the creation of his policies on the border. He's the one who has been jailing people who are seeking asylum. He's the one who has put families in detention. He's the one that ripped children away from their parents. He's the one who fired tear gas at people at the border who were simply standing in line waiting to be processed. So there is a humanitarian crisis, but it's one that he could stop tomorrow by simply ending these brutal tactics.
The president is repeatedly criticizing Democrats in Congress for not taking border security seriously. Do you believe we could do a better job in securing our southern borders?
Yes, and that's why we have given him literally billions of dollars over the last three budgets, to improve border security. We have $1.3 billion that we are ready to deliver to him if he'll just sign the bill to increase border security. But what we've been asking for, if he wants to go bigger or go deeper on this, is to give us a concrete plan, not a plan just for walls, but a plan for the use of technology. We support strong border controls. We support walls or fences where they make sense. But what we're not going to buy into is to give him a lump sum, which is what he's asking for, to build a wall from, these are his words, from sea to shining sea. No border security expert thinks that makes any sense. It's only his effort to keep a campaign promise that he thought he would never have to keep. And he's shutting the government down and jeopardizing the lives of hundreds of thousands of Americans in order to do it. That's just completely irresponsible.
The president wants $5.7 billion for the, air quotes here, the wall. That is a lot of money to you. It's a lot of money to me. But we know it's a pittance when it comes to the entire federal budget. Why is it worth keeping this federal government partially shut down over this amount?
Well, because it's not about the money only. It's about the principle of what we do. Why should we engage in 7th century technology to secure our border and spend almost $6 billion on something that the experts say will not work? One of my colleagues from Virginia, a freshman, Congresswoman Spanberger, worked in the CIA and specifically tracked drug interdiction efforts in the United States, tracked those people that the president pointed out to. In her experience, she spoke this morning, in her experience, they use tunnels, they use ports of entry, they use ships, they use aircraft to get those drugs into this country. We want to stop them, but putting up a wall doesn't stop a truck from crossing the ports of entry. Technology that can sniff those drugs and identify them will. We want to spend money to solve the problem. We just don't want to spend money in order to satisfy Donald Trump's sort of cartoonish impression of what border security should look like. That's what he's asking us to do. And it's not just about $5.7 billion. It's $5.7 billion that would be wasted because it would not solve the problem.
So what is the best way, in your view, to end this impasse and get the entire federal government up and running again?
Well, it would be for the president to submit the need for additional border security to the process of government that we have had in place for 200 years. Send a proposal to Congress. Let us tear that proposal apart, add to it, subtract from it, use the information we have, use the expertise that we can bring in, and put together a border security plan that we think will actually work. We're willing to engage with him on a real plan, but we're not going to adopt his cartoonish approach to this, and we're not going to succumb to his willingness to jeopardize the entire U.S. economy in order to get something that he's unwilling to submit to the legislative process.
Congressman Dan Kildee, Michigan's 5th District, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, two women talk about what it takes to succeed in the male-dominated construction trades.
Yeah, I mean, there's days that, you know, you got all these big, heavy equipments, you know, beeping around you, and you got people yelling at each other, and you got, you know, saws going over here, cutting this, and sparks flying, and you just got to stay focused in that.
That comes up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well over a century ago, somebody in the once-bustling Upper Peninsula town of Fayette wrote out a list of the town's finances and supplies. Well, these days, Fayette is a ghost town, preserved in a state historic park, and that inventory, carefully written by some clerk or accountant, survived, and it became the inspiration for a new typeface called, fittingly, Fayette. It's won praise, it's won awards, and it was designed by Mia Cinelli. She's an assistant professor of art studio and digital design at the University of Kentucky, and she is with us now from Lexington. Let's get this out of the way first, Mia. Define typeface for us and how it's different from font.
Sure. This is a question that I get all the time, and it's a subtle but important difference. So a typeface speaks to what we would call what a particular set of letters look like. And people use typeface and font interchangeably, but in the actual world of type design and typography, a font makes up a typeface. So in the same way that an album is composed of songs, a typeface is made up of fonts. So if you were using something like Baskerville, say, mm-hmm. the design of those particular letters would be a typeface. But if you're using Baskerville Bold, that would be a font.
Got it. I love that album versus the songs. That's just a really good way to put that. So here you are. You designed Fayette, this award-winning typeface. And the story of how you found the inspiration for this typeface is fascinating, and you need to tell it to us.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's an odd story because it almost didn't happen. I was visiting my family in Marquette, Michigan, where I'm from, and I was driving back down to Ann Arbor, where I was living at the time when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan. And normally we take a different way home, and my husband and I were driving, and he said, "Have you ever been to Fayette?" And I said, "No, I don't really know what that is." And he said, "Well, we should go. We'll stop and check it out." And Fayette is a historic town site in the Garden Peninsula of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and it's beautiful. It's just fantastic. If you haven't been there, check it out. It used to be this really bustling town where they smelted iron ore in the 1800s, and then it proved unprofitable and it shut down. But what's left is this beautiful shell of a community, historic buildings, some of which have been kind of gutted and some of which have been preserved. And they had this lovely museum there, and they had kind of in the back this really unassuming kind of sheets of paper. And the closer I got to it, the more excited I became, because it was this handwriting from their kind of unnamed bank teller slash accountant who had kept record of what was needed for the town. And I was really emotionally sideswiped by this, which is like a rare occurrence in your life when something really hits you and you go, "Oh my goodness, this is so beautiful," or "This is so salient." And this was the most beautiful handwriting I'd ever seen. And I was standing there going, "This needs to be a typeface," which was so exciting, except I had never made one before. And so then this started a whole new journey for me of creating this, because I didn't really know what I was doing, except I knew that it needed to get done.
What jumped out at you most from that page and grabbed you? Why did you feel it was just so cool?
You know, there's something about the motion and the connection to corporeality for me, because it came from someone's hand. It's amazing ink handwriting, and someone had done that. Someone sat at some point in time, someone whose name I don't even know, but, you know, whose work has inspired me for many years now, that after I made this typeface, sat there, and it was swooping and really graceful, and all of the letters were perfectly even and beautiful. And I couldn't get over it. Something about that really spoke to me, that this was from a person. You could see their hand and it was so neat.
Tell us how you went about designing this typeface, because you said you had not done one.
I had not, no. We had learned kind of basics in school of typography and a little bit of typeface design. And so outside of the classroom, I really had no experience. And so I really thought it was going to be easier. I went into it going, "Oh, okay, this is going to be, you know, a couple hours and then I'll have this done." And it ended up taking me working every day, all day, about a month and a half to complete this typeface. But this was getting up in the morning at 8, you know, designing till 8 o'clock at night and working on it. And so I started with the lowercase A, which is a really nice kind of place to start, because it gives you the tone of the typeface and then can also lead into other letters. So in this particular typeface, the A is a really nice start of something like a G, right? Or a P or a Q or a B or a D. And so you can use this particular letter form, which is the design of, you know, any one letter in a typeface, to help inform the others. And then from there, I moved on to the H, which helps inform things like the M and the N and the U. And so you start with kind of a core of letters and you build from there, because there is some uniformity that has to happen in a typeface, which does differ a bit from actual handwriting. So it is inspired by these original forms, but not completely true to them.
We dug up a TED Talk that you gave at the University of Michigan in 2016, and there's a pretty funny moment. I want us to take a listen.
So there's at least like one person in this audience right now who's like, "Good for you, lady. You made a typeface. What's the point?"
So can you answer that question for us? What is the point about typeface? What was the point?
I can absolutely answer that. The point is that everybody writes things down in their life, right? You are writing a holiday card, you're writing a memo, you are designing a poster, or you've, you know, written a note to someone. And the thing is that we don't have the benefit of, you know, hearing inflection when we read things, right? Any kind of written language, we can't hear what someone is saying. And so typography is important, because I think of it as a kind of visual inflection. The typeface that you choose, or the way in which you arrange letters in space, which is all that typography is the way in which you say what it is you want to say, because certain typefaces say certain things. And so if you wanted to be really, really sweet, you might choose like a really delicate, beautiful typeface in which to write your message. Or if you really want someone, to take out the smelly trash, maybe you'd write it in a big bold typeface and put it over that. Because if you were to put it in something, you know, like a little cartoon kind of comic typeface, that says something really, really different, even if the actual words that you're using are the same. So type really needs to be thought through in all of its applications in order for people to say what it is they really want to say.
Now, Mia, how long has it been since you designed Fayette?
I designed Fayette in the summer of 2012.
All right, so it's kind of been out there for a little while. What kind of response? I mean, it's award winning, so we know that. But what are you hearing from people? What do they like about it, and what do they use it for?
You know, it's really wild. I, you know, designed this typeface in 2012 and really didn't think that much of it. I just wanted to do it because it was really interesting. And as I mentioned, it was an emotionally, you know, important experience for me. And since then, it's just like really taken off. I get emails from people every week from all over the world. I get people from Romania, from India, from Russia, from Australia, from South America, from the US, from Michigan, who say, I saw your TED Talk, or I Googled this and it's beautiful, or I thought it was interesting and I'd like a copy. Or people say it reminds me of my grandmother's handwriting, which is something that always really gets me, because that's, you know, preserving the past into the present, which was kind of the whole point of making this. But people also just say, I really want to use it on a project for school or for work. And what I like about it is that once you've made a typeface and once it goes out into the world, you don't really have any control as to how it's used. But that's actually kind of exciting, because people get to then take it and make it their own and use it in a whole bunch of applications. So for me, that's really thrilling and really exciting to have something that you've made be used and appreciated. And even if, you know, people don't use the typeface, even if they're thinking a little bit more clearly about how they're using type or the type that they see around them, for me, that's such a huge win as a designer, to make people a bit more cognizant of that. It's really just super exciting.
And I guess people are going to be listening to us talking about it. We're going to be able to put a sample of it up on our website. But if people wanted to use it, how do they find Fayette?
Sure. Well, if people find Fayette through me, I've been personally distributing it really since I made it. It's not commercially available yet, but I give it away for free. So if people are interested, they can check it out on my website and be in touch, and I'd be happy to send them a copy. But I'm a pretty busy person, so sometimes it takes me a couple weeks to answer my email.
Well, it is lovely, and it does make one stop and think about that person, whoever it was, all those years ago that set down that handwriting that caught your eye.
Absolutely.
Mia Cinelli, Assistant Professor of Art Studio and Digital Design at the University of Kentucky, designer of the award-winning Fayette typeface. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
When you're taking the very first steps down a career path, it can feel like taking a leap into the unknown. On the flip side, if you've been walking on that road a while, chances are you have learned a thing or two. Today on Stateside, we continue our series, Work in Progress, a series of conversations between two people at opposite ends of the same career path. Today, we'll hear from two women who work in the skilled trades, jobs like electrician, plumber, construction worker, a field where women make up only around 9% of workers.
My name is Grace Trudell. I'm a business representative with the IBEW Local 58 in Detroit. I started my apprenticeship back in 99 and got my journeyman's card in 2004. And I also chair the women's committee for our local.
My name is Samantha Forsyth. I just finished the WIST Women in Skilled Trades Apprenticeship Readiness Program. And I am interested in applying for the apprenticeship for the electrical union.
When did you first realize that you wanted to be an electrician?
I never really thought it was really even an option. You go through high school and they are always pushing, you have to get a college degree or you're not going to make it anywhere.
Right.
So I went the college route right out of high school, but I couldn't afford to go full time.
Right.
So I was doing that part time and working full time, and it just wasn't working out for me. But my sister actually always changed her own brakes, you know, showed me how to change oil in my car. And I've always been a really hands-on learner, and I've always loved math. So my aunt actually came to me with this program she just thought I was perfect for it because I'm a single mom now, too.
Yeah.
And so the thought of benefits and retirement, I did a couple job shadows with an electrician and saw the nature of the work. And yeah. I had a really great guy that I followed around, Courtney, that just showed me everything, the way things worked and sussing out the problems, you know, and the avenue he used to get to that solution. It was just really inspiring and really exciting. So, but when did you want to become an electrician? You said you didn't do it right out of high school.
Oh, no, no. I didn't get started until 99. And actually, I was married at the time. And my brother-in-law was a cement mason, a teacher at their apprenticeship. And he had a booklet that listed all the trades from A to Z. At that time, I was working with kids, you know, and I had been for like 8 or 9 years. So as I was looking through that book, I was like, working with kids, we do crafts, and I was always good with my hands. And I've done work around the house, and I helped him, you know, with our cement driveway. But as I was looking at it, I was looking at what careers paid the most, first of all, and which ones I qualified for. And that was either a plumber or an electrician. And the more I thought about it, I was like, you know what? I don't want to really be dealing with toilets that much. So I decided I'm going to give the electrical field a try. So I go on the job, and I'm just in awe. It was exciting. And then the first time I went into an auto plant, I was still in awe. And then the first time I went to the steel mill, I felt like a little ant, and I was still in awe about, you know, all the different things. So what do you hope your life looks like in the future if you get accepted into the program?
I'm really actually excited about the hours from 6 to 3, basically, or 7 to 3. Before this, I was a bartender, a server. I was always working at night, you know, working way into the early hours in the morning. And it's so frustrating when you go to work and it's dark, and you get out of work and it's dark, and it's just
winter in Michigan.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a job as a landscaper for a little while, and I just loved those hours, just getting up early in the morning to doing physical work and being done by 3 or 4 in the afternoon and still having the rest of your day. I'm really excited about that, and just the steady pay. And just the benefits and security, you know, being a single mom, just having that insurance and, you know, retirement, there's room for advancement, you know, and it's just, it makes your future just look so much brighter. What kind of person do you think you need to be successful in this type of trade?
I think someone with a strong will and determination, someone that has a thick skin, obviously. This is definitely one of those careers that there's going to be some negativity around you just because you're a woman. That can be hard at times, but it takes, like I said, it takes a special type of person, strong-willed, strong determination, and someone that's focused on what they want, their end goals. And it's definitely a physical job, too.
Yes, for sure.
Which is nice because, yeah. You know, most people pay for gym memberships. This one, you don't have to because you can go to work, get paid, and, you know, still stay fit. What are some of the things that you see positively in the future for this trade?
I really am very inspired by just the WISP program in general, committees like yours that are really pushing women to get into this trade. We went through the statistics. There's only like 9% of the construction trade is women. What I want to see is just more inclusion, you know, on the job site. You know, I want it to be not abnormal to see a woman, you know, mm-hmm. in a hard hat. Do you have any tricks actually getting into the field of things that would help me along the way?
Just be honest. You know, look people in the eye and tell them why you want to do this, what your experience has been in the past. Working as a bartender definitely gives you some people skills that, you know, they might not be the greatest people at the time. They might be the nicest person in the world, but give them a few drinks and they're not so great to deal with. But you're dealing with that already, right? First year with us is pretty much, you know, safety. Because that's a huge thing. And I think that's another thing, too, that women may be a little bit more apt to, because we're not dealing with the machismo, you know, of like, oh, I can do this. I don't need that. You know, it's like, well, wait a minute. I could actually get hurt by doing this. And the safety rules are in effect for a reason. and as being moms. We all know how multitasking can be and working in chaos. So, yeah, I mean, there's days that, you know, you got all these big, heavy equipments, you know, beeping around you, and you got people yelling at each other, and you got, you know, saws going over here, cutting this, and sparks flying, and you just got to stay focused in that. So that's something I think women are good at, too, is, you know, the multitasking and to be able to tune out certain things.
You get lots of practice of that.
Exactly. Do you have any, hesitation on getting into the trade? Do you have any concerns, or is something that, you know, kind of scares you from making that leap?
I mean, going into something brand new that you've never had any exposure really to on a daily basis is always going to be intimidating. Learning a completely different career path than I ever thought. And at my age, I'm 35. Trying to start all over again, it feels like doing something new is a little intimidating. And just being a woman in general in a man's world, so far I've been greeted with nothing but amazing gentlemen to help me along the way. But I know, you know, that you're going to feel a little lost at first. You're going to feel a little, you know, the odd man out or odd woman out.
Yeah, for
on a construction site.
You know, it's always kind of scary to go into the unknown. But knowing what the outcome is on the other side, you know, and looking at your son, looking at him and saying, you know, this is what mom did, and he's going to look at you with a lot of pride, too. So that's pretty cool.
That was Grace Trudell, a union rep with Detroit IBEW Local 58, and Samantha Forsyth, a recent graduate of the Women in Skilled Trades Pre-Apprentice Program. Coming up, we'll hear from a self-proclaimed water protector. She's camping all through the winter, demanding the shutdown of Enbridge Line 5.
What is at stake? Is my home. My home is at stake. My first medicine is at stake. Everything's at stake.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk about our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
The end of child labor, a 40-hour work week, the right for workers to bargain collectively, minimum wage, even the right to talk in a lunchroom. Just some of the rights that organized labor has fought for. Often the battle for these rights was long and tough and involved strikes. Sometimes strikes turned into fights. This week marks the 82nd anniversary of one of those important labor fights known as the Battle of the Running Bulls. It happened at GM's Fisher Body No. 2 plant in Flint. So let's go back 82 years as we say hello to the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Rachel, set the stage for us. What was going on between GM and its workers in January 1937?
By January of 1937, Flint workers had been involved in what is now known as the Flint sit-down strike. It began the end of December of 36 and had been continuing on. And so the workers were trying to get the UAW recognized as a collective bargaining agent for themselves with General Motors.
So they wanted the UAW to speak for them. GM was not inclined to do that. So that sit-down strike, it was actually more than one plant, wasn't it? Because we had Fisher Body No. 1 and Fisher Body No. 2. So this was a big deal.
It was. It moved into multiple plants over the course of the entire strike.
So what happened on January 11th, 1937, when this Battle of the Running Bulls erupted?
Up until that point, things within the strike had been pretty calm, even boring. People who were involved in the strike had talked about just sitting around and not really doing much. But by the 11th, General Motors ordered the heat to the Fisher 2 building cut off and food supplies blocked at the gate. So the company was now looking back. It's pretty clear that General Motors at that point intended to take Fisher 2 back from the strikers. And so they turned off the heat and shut off all food access, taken ladders down that people had been using to bring supplies to the strikers. And then as people were starting to push through the gate to get to the building, company police were called in and Flint police were called in.
Okay, so that amped things up considerably then. When Flint police get called in, What happened? What did this battle look like?
So as Flint police come in, they arrive with tear gas guns, and they start firing tear gas into the plant and into the group of strike supporters that are outside of the plant. So the strikers inside the plant at this point open up the windows not only to get some air into the plant, but they start throwing things out of the windows. And some of the things they start throwing out are just these enormous steel hinges for cars, bottles, just whatever they can find. And they start throwing it out the window at the police. And this is the Flint police. By this time, General Motors, the company police, had retreated. And so they start throwing things out, and the Flint police retreat, sort of collect themselves back up again, and then return again with more tear gas.
So this is this Battle of the Running Bulls is a riot in a sense.
Yes.
Who got hurt? How many got hurt or arrested?
When all is said and done, you've got 14 strikers and strike sympathizers who are hurt. Two spectators, who are just sort of people that were there, are wounded, along with 9 police officers. And some of these injuries come from gunshot wounds. Some of it is tear gas, responses to tear gas, and then getting hit with things being thrown out of the plant itself.
General Motors, I'm sure, made some calls to Michigan Governor Frank Murphy. What was the response from the governor and from the state of Michigan?
The governor's response, in my opinion, I think it's very interesting what he ends up doing. Keep in mind, Governor Murphy, by this point, he's newly elected. So it would be as if Governor Whitmer now had to respond to something like this as a newly elected governor. He is very pro-labor. Everybody knows that. That's not really a secret at that point. But he also owns stock in General Motors. So he has a lot of interest in this. So what he ends up doing, he does a couple of things. The first thing he does is he orders General Motors to turn the heat back on and allow food supplies back into the plant. And the second thing he does is he orders the mobilization of the Michigan State Police and the Michigan National Guard into Flint.
And what did he instruct the National Guard to do or not do?
This was a bit of a surprise to people. Based on National Guard movement in labor disputes in the past, the National Guard was always brought in to quell the strike or to quell the disturbance. And so people assumed the National Guard was going to go into Flint and remove the strikers from Fisher 2 and Fisher 1. But their orders from Murphy were essentially to just keep the workers and General Motors police and Flint police away from each other. So that way, peace would sort of ensue for long enough for General Motors and the strikers to sit down and come to some sort of agreement. So the National Guard was essentially sent in as peacekeepers in this point, which didn't make General Motors very happy because their assumption was that the Guard was going to go in and end the strike for them.
So basically the state didn't take sides.
No, Governor Murphy did not. National Guard just went in and did their job. State police went in and did their job, and it worked in the end.
And what about President Franklin Roosevelt?
President Roosevelt actually ended up sending in some of his own labor people to try to figure out what was going on and try to come to some peaceful end of this. It's during the Depression. It was really starting to hit the economy pretty hard as General Motors stops producing cars. And so Roosevelt ends up sending in some of his own labor people to try to convince not only General Motors, but to sort of push Murphy into a particular, not a corner so much, but just to get him to do some things to bring this to a close.
So how did this all end and when did it end?
So in the end, the strike lasted until February 11th of 37. And because of the production shutdown, not only in Flint, but in other plants across the Midwest, General Motors production actually ended up almost coming to a complete halt. And so by February of 1937, General Motors agreed to recognize the UAW as a collective bargaining unit, and the strike came to an end.
And what changed for workers in their day-to-day life or in their pay?
A lot of the things they asked for are things that you would sort of expect. The speed of the line, they wanted that to slow down. But some of the stranger things, they were allowed now to speak together in the cafeteria. Before, they weren't allowed to talk at their lunch breaks, but they can now. And they also get a 5% raise, which during the Depression era, that's a sizable increase. So they ended up getting about a dozen requests out of this.
And I've got to ask, and maybe nobody knows the answer, how did this battle get the name the Battle of the Running Bulls?
The thing that I have heard is because bull is used sometimes as a term for police or even hired police, and because they did retreat, they used the play on the Battle of the Running Bulls as the police retreating and the victory of the strikers. But I don't know that that's true. I've just read that in various spots.
Rachel Clark with the Michigan History Center, taking us back to a very important moment in labor history, the Battle of the Running Bulls, 82 years ago this week, outside the GM Fisher Body Plant Number 2 in Flint. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
It's the dead of winter near the Straits of Mackinac. Snow is piled up. Nighttime temps drop into single digits. But that is not deterring the Native American protesters at Camp Anishinaabeg. It was set up last summer near Levering in Emmett County to demand the shutdown of Enbridge Line 5, a peaceful protest by people who call themselves water protectors. Here now from Camp Anishinaabeg is water protector Sarah Jo Showman. And Sarah, explain the significance of the name chosen for this camp.
Anishinaabeg Camp. Anishinaabeg is who we are, these original people that were here first. So we're trying to convert this camp into like a permanent camp almost, after this is all done, as like a prayer camp and just living in harmony with the earth, just how we used to be back before everything happened, you know, like we're trying to take it back.
And the camp was set up in August, and the intention is to stay there until what exactly, Sarah Jo?
We're going to stay camping until hopefully the pipeline's closed and there's no tunnel, no nothing, because that's what we want. We want nothing. But we might not stay in this exact location. I think we're going to get closer to the bridge or closer to where construction will be.
This is a real commitment to stay at this camp as a water protector. Sarah Jo, why are you there? Why did you take on this role of water protector?
To me, and how I live, it's like brushing your teeth in the morning. It's something you got to do, you know? It's almost as crucial as your morning bathroom break. You know, right when you wake up, you go straight to the bathroom. That's how this feels. It's just as urgent as, to me like that.
Why?
Because when I pass over in how I think, my ancestors are going to ask me what I did to protect this land that they gave me, and they gave everything to me to live. They're going to ask me what I did, and I can't say that I didn't do anything.
With the camp set up in August, 5 months later, now we're in wintertime, how many water protectors are camping?
Let me see. There's me, my uncle, Morgan, Winona, Sean, Nancy, Noah, 5, 6, 7. There's 8 who are permanents.
And then do you have people kind of come and go as well?
Oh, yeah. We have people coming in and out all day, all night.
I'm interested if you have a sense of how many tribes are represented, whether there are people from outside Michigan, and whether there are people who are coming who are not Native American, but who feel solidarity with you.
Oh, yeah. We have plenty of allies. I went to Standing Rock, that battle that happened in North Dakota about 2 years ago. That was my first time doing anything like this. And when I went out there, I met so many great people of all different backgrounds, of all different income backgrounds. Like, it didn't even matter. And they're all coming back to me now. So, yeah, we have tons of allies and people who come all day who are all different nations.
Because Standing Rock, boy, that got a lot of not only national but international attention. Is it your hope to kind of follow that path?
I want it to get that big because it's our Great Lakes, you know. Everyone relies on these Great Lakes. They're international waters. So this should be an international battle, but if it's not, I can do it. I'll do it if I'm alone, or I'll do it if there's a million people staying behind me. It really doesn't matter to me at this point.
Sarah Jo, talk to us a little about what it is like. I mean, it's a little different than when you began this in August. So, you know, how much snow is on the ground? How cold is it?
It's so cold. Oh, my gosh. I was cramping up all day yesterday because it was so cold. We got about a good, I'd say about a foot out there, a good foot of snow.
What are you doing to stay warm here? Because you're all in tents, right?
Yep. We insulate them really well, and then we have a wood stove in there.
Keep the fires burning.
Oh, yeah. Got to keep them burning hot.
Take us through like a typical day at Camp Anishinaabeg. What kinds of things are you doing?
You wake up because it's cold. Your fire went out. That's your alarm clock here, is if your fire goes out. And then you have to get up out of bed. I usually walk around the camp, and I try to make this camp better every single day. Like, whether that's cleaning up, minimizing everything, or trying to think of a better, efficient way to make a tent more solid. If I'm not doing any actions that day, or, like, there's no one planned, I try to make this camp better than what it was yesterday.
When you say actions, what kind of actions?
I'm sorry, I don't feel comfortable discussing those over the phone. I would have to have you here.
Why are you uncomfortable talking about them?
Because I've done this before, and I know, I don't know, I just don't want to get hurt.
Sarah Jo, you said to us a moment ago that you'd been hurt. How were you hurt?
When I was in Standing Rock, I did a lot. I didn't wear a face mask, so my identity was completely revealed, you know, and I got into a real bad car accident, and I don't know, it was just a real weird car accident, and like, all my uncles were on security, too, so, like, I don't know.
So you're actually questioning what that accident was about?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, like, my tires would be slashed.
I want to circle back to what you described as you kind of talked about, you know, the fires are going, you wake up, it's cold, you try to make the camp better each day. I've got to wonder if you think of your ancestors as you do that, and does this make you feel closer in a sense of kind of the way they lived is what you're doing now?
Yes, and it goes for everything. When I touch the ground, I swear I can feel them. When I touch a certain tree, like, I swear, like, I can feel them still, you know, and my family comes from this area. I was raised in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, but that's a boarding school city, you see. Mm-hmm. So all the children got pulled from everywhere to go to there. But my family was from up here. And when I go to bays, when I go to the bays here, I can, for some reason, I can picture my ancestors rolling in all these canoes. And yeah, I feel very close with them here, closer than I've ever been. And I think that's kind of why I like being here, too, because, like, I'm happy for no reason. Like, I wake up smiling. I don't wake up smiling at home. This lifestyle makes me happy.
We have a new governor. We have a new state attorney general. And both have been very open about wanting to decommission Line 5. We know that Governor Whitmer asked Attorney General Dana Nessel to review that new public act that sets up the tunnel project that Governor Snyder wanted to replace the Line 5 pipelines with lines in a tunnel. What do you want to say to our new state leaders and to the legislature?
Well, I appreciate them for even thinking about it, for even talking about it, because I know it's hard up there. I mean, I don't know how hard it is, but I know it can be hard. And I really appreciate them doing that. But I don't fully believe in them and what they do. I'm sorry, but it's just the way history wrote itself. I can't fully believe them or her because look what happened the last time we believed them, you know? And I don't know. I hope they do for them, for their family, for their kids, for when they pass. I hope they do, but if they don't, I'm prepared for that.
And when you say, look what happened, you're talking about back in the 1800s.
Yep.
If not earlier. Yeah. What is at stake for you, Sarah Jo, and the other water protectors?
What is at stake is my home. My home is at stake. My first medicine is at stake. Everything's at stake. You know, my people come from this land. I couldn't imagine it being so toxic you can't even be around it, you know. And the citizens of Northern Michigan are going to have to clean this up, just like Kalamazoo. And that was Enbridge as well. We're going to be left with all of this from a foreign company.
As you're there in the woods, Sarah Jo Shoman, and you say you can feel your ancestors, what are they telling you to do?
They're telling me to fight. They tell me to fight. Even if you don't win, you fight. Because they fought. They fought so hard for me. They didn't even know me, and they were fighting for me, you know? I'm just hoping I make them proud.
Sarah Jo Shoman is one of the water protectors who's spending this winter dug in at Camp Anishinaabeg in northern Michigan, keeping watch over the Straits of Mackinac and calling for a shutdown of Enbridge Line 5. Sarah Jo, we want to thank you for talking with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Enbridge, which is a corporate sponsor, sent us a statement which reads, in part, and I quote, "Enbridge recognizes the rights of people to express their views legally and peacefully and to discuss Enbridge's business and projects. We encourage active discussions on our operations and projects as long as everyone is respectful of those who live and work near our pipelines, including our employees and contractors and of our pipelines and facilities." Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.